Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Canine Connection Podcast. Today is episode 6, and we're going to continue talking about errors. So I'm going to let Lori start, because first thing we're going to talk about is identifying the root cause of an error, right? When an error occurs, we can't treat them all the same. We have to ask ourselves, why did this error happen? So Lori, why don't you give us some reasons why errors happen?
Yeah, so when an error occurs, when my dog makes a mistake, so the first thing is I kind of have like a little short list of questions I'll ask myself. Why did the error occur? Was it because I handled incorrectly? Meaning, if it was a physical cue, did I do it wrong and I wasn't consistent and the dog didn't understand that? Or was it pressure that caused my dog to make the error? Meaning, was my dog in a situation feeling pressure in obedience? It would be something like a judge behind the dog, ring gates up close to the dog, things like that, that could cause pressure, which could cause the dog to not be able to do that behavior under those circumstances. Another reason, which is a big one, would be distractions. That's a big one, because all it takes is the dog to lose that absolute acute focus on us. If something were to happen behind us, to the side of us, and that could be anything from odor, they pick up a scent. It could be motion. It could be auditory, where they hear something, somebody drops the boards to a jump at a trial and the next ring, the dog goes to turn to look at it and they miss either the signal or whatever cue we're giving them. So those are pretty much the main questions I ask myself. And depending on, a lot of it too depends on where my dog is in their training, right? So that's a big one too is, you know, do I have a dog who made an error who's fully trained, you know, like Ever or, Ever and Zesty are, I would still say that they're fully trained. They're still green, but they're fully trained where, you know, is it an error that they don't understand the actual behavior because they're still in the learning process? That would be more for like a younger green dog, like Stormy, who's just 2, right? So she's still learning all the stuff. So those are the questions you got to ask yourself too, is, you know, the error makes a difference in the, where your dog is in their training stages, a fully trained dog versus a young green dog, right?
Can I just throw another one in there?
Yeah.
Chaining. So some errors occur because of the length of the chain, right? So when we start putting multiple behaviors together, the dog is used to a certain reinforcement rate, and that's information. I don't believe the dog gets struggles because they're not getting a cookie and they're only working for the cookie. I believe that the dog is confused because the dog's getting told every X amount of time, that's correct. And all of a sudden you make that chain twice as long, and the dog's confused. And if you put together a really long chain, like a full class, sometimes the error that happens is simply because the dog is confused because it hasn't gotten any information for a long period of time.
Right. And all these things, you know, all these little questions I ask, you know, these are things that I'm always consciously training for, you know, as we're training the dogs up through since they're puppies all the way up to when they're fully trained. So it can, you know, it can be, it's never going to be, and I think we touched on this in our last episode, that the dogs just aren't just blowing us off if an error occurs. Dogs do not think that way. It is always going to be a training issue of some sort. So as soon as an error occurs, and sometimes we don't know, right? Like sometimes when an error occurs, we don't really know the answer right away until we've talked about this too, until sometimes we put it aside or shelf it and we have to play detective. We go down that road and we have to figure out why it occurred because sometimes it's not obvious, right? But those are the chaining and distractions, pressure, and handling. You know, those are to me the big four that would be the four reasons why a dog would make an error.
And I also think for a lot of people, it's part of it is lack of fluency. So my personal definition, this is just my definition of fluency, right? Is that I give a cue, my dog responds immediately to the cue.
Right.
It responds immediately. The behavior gives me meets my criteria that I've taught the dog, right? So I say sit. My dog sits immediately and puts their butt all the way on the ground. And my dog does this consistently over time, meaning not just once in a training session or once every 3 or 4 reps or 3 or 4 training sessions. Like every time I say to my dog, sit, my dog slams her butt down immediately and all is good. So what happens is people don't train the individual pieces thoroughly enough. So that when they start putting the pieces together, it falls apart because the dog is confused because you've never really taught it to fluency. Like you haven't taught the behavior thoroughly enough. In your human mind, people often think they have, but I look at it and I'm like, your dog's not doing it. You're like, you're right there in front of the dog. You're telling them do X behavior. Your dog's not doing it. You didn't teach it well enough. And right. Only you, and I think people deep down, like, so if I were to confront a student and say, does your dog do that 100% all the time? Like, does a dog really know that? They'll be like, no. Then I'm like, well, then why are you trying to put it all together? I don't know. They always say, so when people are like, well, yeah, my dog knows it. I feel like if you really are sit down in a quiet room and are honest with yourself, you will be able to say my dog knows it well enough or not. And if you're really not sure, it's super easy to test it, right? Just go in a space where you train your dog that's familiar, right? Your backyard, your training building, right? No distractions, no pressure, no nothing. Isolate the behavior. Have the dog do that exercise or that series of behaviors. Does your dog do it correctly? And does your dog do it correctly for multiple reps and meet criteria? If the answer is yes, then I would say, good, your dog knows it. If the answer is no, then your dog doesn't know it well enough. You need to go back and work through those, you know, strengthen those individual pieces before putting it back together.
Yeah, agree. And thinking more about more reasons, I'm just thinking too, we have to also talk about generalization mm-hmm. with dogs, right? Yeah. That's a big one because, you know, dogs see in pictures and you'll be able to teach your dog a behavior at home in your kitchen. And then you say, yep, it's fluent. The dog does it 99.5% to 100% consistently in my kitchen. But then you go to take it in a different location. And the dog looks at you like they've never seen that before in their life. So you have to just always, I think a big one, the biggest one I would say in competition obedience would be as far as generalizing, and we're always, always making sure the dogs see tons of picture is in utility. There's a directed jumping exercise and the dogs have to do, the first part of it is to do a go out, which means they have to be sent 50 feet down to the other end of the ring. And that picture always changes. Like, there is never the same picture. Never. And so that's a big one, like, where we want to make sure the dogs can still find center line straight down when we mark, no matter what the backdrop is, right?
So why don't we take each one individually, like, from what I would consider personally the easiest one, and then upward and difficulty, and how we would handle it and how we would identify that, right? So, for example, with handling, like, when I'm healing, if my dog makes an error in healing, I will never say they're wrong. Because first I have to make sure that I didn't muck it up, right? Because there's a really good chance that my handling was not absolutely spot on. So, for example, if I'm healing and I do an about turn and my dog's not, like, right there, I'll just do it again. And when I do it again, I make sure that my handling is 100% perfect. And surprise, surprise, 99% of the time, my dog's about turn is perfect. Yeah. If my handling is perfect and my dog is still out of position, then I can say, okay, it was my handling did not create that error, right? Same with, for example, if I'm doing a moving stand. Like, I have two dogs, they prefer two different signals in the moving stand. I have given the wrong signal to the wrong dog. So if my dog doesn't immediately lock up, the first thing I say to myself is, did I give the right signal? And right. Did I do it? Did I execute it perfectly? Because maybe my brain started to do one and then went to do the other. And I did that dog signal, but it was weird. It wasn't exactly the way I usually do it. So same, I'll just release my dog. I'm not going to say, dog, you were wrong. You didn't stop the way I wanted. I'm going to do it again, give my absolute correct signal, and 99.9% of the time, my dog will then, oh, surprise, stop perfectly. If my dog doesn't, okay, good. Then I can rule out that I made a handling error.
Yeah. And I would say, let's go into pressure, right? So, let's give an example. So say you're training with somebody and they're playing judge and you set your dog up for a novice stand for exam, right? The judge is usually within 6 feet of you for that, part of the exercise. But when we're training, a lot of the times we're not really paying attention to where our helper is, and they're probably closer than they really need to be as they would be at a trial. So if I ask my dog to stand and my dog doesn't, and I notice that my helper is standing a little close, that would probably be something for me to say, this is probably a pressure situation because this person's pretty close to my dog. So then how I would handle that is I would just ask my friend or helper to just go farther away. Significantly, can my dog do it without the pressure of somebody standing there? My dog can do it, no problem. So right there, I would probably just say that I identify this error as probably a pressure error, right? So that's probably how I would dissect the pressure one.
And pressure, we could do like a whole episode just on that. But people always ask me, what's the difference between distraction and pressure? So the way I view it in my dogs, I don't know if you would agree with this or not, but for me, a distraction, like, especially when my dog's learning, they're curious. They're like, oh, what's that over there? What's that noise? What's that smell? What's that motion? What's happening over there? It's more like curiosity. They're like, what's going on over there? Pressure is always uncomfortable. Like, there no time, at 100% of the time, pressure, when a dog feels pressure, it's uncomfortable. They don't like it. So they could feel pressure from the environment, from the judge, from ring gates. They could also feel pressure from us. Like a really common one is an agility when dogs have trouble doing a weave pole entry, right? So what happens? I see this on video all the time and I'm like, oh God, the person's trying to quote unquote help the dog get into that entry and they're converging on the dog and converging on the weave poles and they're like, weave, and the dog's like, I'm out. And then all it does is confirm, like, see, my dog has a weave pole entry. And I feel like saying, like, just back away.
Yeah.
Stand away off to the side. Indicate the entry. Stop screaming. Let the dog find it. Right? And then in training, click the dog, whatever. People in certain sports, like they don't take into account that the judge being there or moving is impacting the dog. They're just looking at the dog and they're saying the dog didn't do the obstacle or the dog didn't bring me the bumper or the dog didn't do the drop on recall. So therefore the dog didn't do the behavior I asked it to do. And really the dog is just trying to escape the pressure that's making them uncomfortable. So if you were to then say to the dog, naughty dog, don't do that. The dog's going to have an even more negative association with pressure. So now the dog's going to see pressure and go, oh God, not only am I uncomfortable with the pressure, something's going to go bad and I'm going to get in trouble too. And it just goes horribly down a rabbit hole.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think another big one too to talk about is that, you know, we inadvertently put pressure on the dogs. Mm-hmm. And I think people don't, they, especially when something starts to unravel a little bit in whatever we're doing in our dog sport, we tend to bend over our dogs quite a bit. I don't know what it is about that. When things start to go downhill, we're like lowering ourselves.
Yes, I know.
And you can see if you really watch, like really start to pay attention to look for them, you will start to see how the dogs react to that pressure under pressure at a trial or whatever competition you're doing. The dogs just want to escape it, right? So that's a big common thing I see. I even catch myself doing it, you know, as soon as I start to feel like, oh, this isn't feeling good. This is feeling starting to feel icky. I catch my posture even, like I start bending over, even when I'm healing. Or if the dog doesn't set up on the first try, when you're in the ring, people start bending over and patting their legs. I said, set up. And the dog just keeps backing up and backing up. So,
yeah. And they get pitchy. Final, come over here. And the dog's like, oh my God, like what just happened to my mom? Like, I don't even know what happened. That standing up thing is so important. I can't tell you how many times that saved my dogs in the ring.
Yeah.
And I, to this day, I feel the natural urge to bend. I've just have absolutely disciplined myself that like, and as soon as, if I'm healing and I feel like my dog's like losing a little bit of attention or getting a little bit nervous, right? What do we want to do? We want to bend down to go look in my eyes or yes, pay attention to me. And I do the opposite. I stand up super tall. And ironically enough, that's what draws the dog up to you, right? Is standing up, moving away from the dog, draws the dog into your space.
Right.
And I think in my head, the words I say in my head to my dogs are, you're fine, it's all good, just keep going. And I have visibly seen on many occasions where one of my dogs is like, kind of getting nervous and I stand up and I think that in my head and all of a sudden my dog like snaps out of it and like, okay, I got the dog back. I have never gotten my dog back, not once, when I leaned.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to just tell a little bit of a story here. So yesterday, actually, this is perfect timing. I was training Stormy and we were outside at some, it was a busy place. The traffic was going by. There were people walking. And Stormy's had a little bit of a fear of bicycles for probably the past couple months. She gets a little nervous. She gets a little worried when she sees one go by. I don't know why, but she does. And it'll pass. So I try not to make a big deal out of it. But as I'm training her, I notice she's eye flicking away and she, I look to see where she's looking with my eyes. And sure enough, there's somebody and they were probably 200 feet away. They were just riding their bike down the sidewalk. And I could tell she started to get nervous and worried. And my first reaction, which is what most of us want to do, like biologically, we are just programmed to do it. I started, Storm, up here, Storm, up here, what can you do? Like, and I'm like in her face and I'm getting louder. And I heard your words in my head and I'm like, shut up, Lori, stand up and just let her like be drawn back into you. And I did. And it's really hard to do that. Like, when people hopefully listen to this and they're like, I'm going to start to try to really consciously not do that to my dog, it takes a lot of mindful concentration to really do that. Mm-hmm. And I heard you in my head and I shut up and I just.
Sorry.
That's okay. Are you all right?
This is normal. No one's allowed near my house, FYI. So,
yes, so don't go to Patriot's house unannounced.
Yes, don't come here unannounced. That's what
So I gave her, and it felt like the longest, like 5 seconds of my life, because I want, like, it's a control thing, I think, on my part too. Like, I want to fix it. I want to get in there. I need to help her, and I just shut up. I stood up. I was just in my head, like, you got this, girl. And she looked at me, and all of a sudden, she just engaged beautifully back with me, and back to work she went. So,
yeah, I do. I think it's that. Well, one thing that people do is they panic.
Yeah.
So they don't know what to do, so they micromanage, right? So that's when I say to them, do nothing. Like, shut up, number one, because dogs aren't verbal anyway. So all you're doing is distracting them, right? You're throwing words at them that's distracting them and it's going to stress them out.
Yep.
So I'm always like, stop talking, be quiet, stand up tall. And a lot of times just wait. Like, we kind of, like you said, like, want to micromanage or we want to fix it, or we're like, ah, just stop. Like, just like you as a trainer have to process what you're going to do, which is why training's really hard for everyone, even harder for beginners, because there's so much going on and your brain as a human can't process everything quickly enough, right? So the dog's the same way. So, like, the dog needs time to process and go, okay, bicycle's over there. Okay, but mom's over there. Oh, mom looks okay. Right. When mom stands still and does nothing, I'm supposed to do this offering thing, right? Yeah. Well, for the dog to come to that conclusion, it's going to take 5-10 seconds,
yeah.
Right? Like, it's not going to just, like, flip a switch and do it. But if you give them that freedom, then A, it's empowering because they got to make the decision themselves. It makes them more confident and it takes pressure off, right? Like, when my dog is under pressure, I want my dog to look at me and go, okay, that's always a safe space, right?
Right.
Like, no matter what happens when I'm under pressure, if I connect with mom, she's got my back and it's all going to be good, right? And that develops over time, and it only develops over time if I'm consistently saying to my dog, it's fine, you're good, it's fine, you're good. And I just, like, I don't add any additional pressure to the dog, right? If anything, I'm going to, for lack of a better word, like rescue my dog out of there before I would put my dog under more pressure, right? Like I'm never going to add pressure to pressure because that's the worst thing you can do. And yeah, like people, I feel like I just had a student recently like that did that. Like the dog was struggling. So she like ran up to the dog and I'm like, the dog was like, you know? And so again, videotape, super important because the dog is not going to look happy. So like if you bend down or move towards your dog or do anything and your dog's ears go back or your dog leans back or turns their head away, right? Those are all signs that the dog's like saying, I don't like that. I'm not comfortable with that, right? So that if you don't catch it in the moment, if you videotape it and you go back and you look at your videotape and you see, oh, look, I did X and then my dog reacted like that. Oh, I don't think my dog likes that, right? And then you're going to, over time, you'll get better and better at reading it and eventually you'll be able to read it like in real time and then remind yourself like, oh, shoot, you know, I better back off.
And, yeah.
You know, and even praise, like I've had students where they're not allowed to talk at all. They are not even allowed to verbally praise their dogs because their dog gets flat or worried or struggles and they get pitchy. Good girl. That was so good. Wow. What a good dog. There's a lot of pressure behind that. Right. Yeah. And the dog's like, holy shit. So it is the most freaking amazing thing I've ever seen. The difference is night and day. I have to see if I can find a student that's done this that I can get the before and after. It's like they praise like that. And the dog's just like away from them. The dog's like, oh God, the dog doesn't act happy at all.
Yeah.
I go, you can't talk. If you use a verbal marker, like, yes, that's all you're allowed to say. And then people get completely befuddled. They're like, well, how do I praise the dog? I'm like, well, exactly the same way, except no words. So then they feel like they have to like jump up and down or do we? I'm like, no, 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 don't do any of that. Do the exact same thing you were doing before. Just say the words in your head. Same body, same thing. Just say the words in your head. They do that. And the dog is so happy and relaxed. It is like a night and day difference.
Right.
And this is, you know, it's not everybody, but it's like, I'm thinking of a specific example. It's a super sensitive dog, like a very sensitive dog, and a handler that's, you know, like a confident, stronger handler. And she just tries too hard. So she'd switch to that. And it was amazing, the difference. You know, so pressure is huge. I mean, I think people are so lucky now because, I mean, back when I was training Zeal, nobody talked about pressure. It was not a thing. Like,
yeah,
nobody talked about it. There were no techniques on how to handle it. Nobody even acknowledged it. It was kind of like, if things get hard, dog must just suck it up and do it. But like a true understanding of pressure, true understanding of how it affects the dog and techniques to get the dog to handle, to have a positive association with a dog instead of negative association did not exist. Like
which is crazy because if you really think about it, dogs understand pressure the best. Like they
300%.
Understand. Yes. It's crazy. Like, so if you go and watch like coyotes or wolves and how they interact in the wild, it's all through pressure. Mm-hmm. All of it, all their communications through pressure. It's just their entire like vocabulary is through pressure. So dogs understand it so well.
Yeah. And so I learned all about pressure from a behaviorist.
Yeah.
And so this behaviorist taught me all about it, taught me how to read it, et cetera, et cetera. Then she had some techniques, but I had to figure out how to like extrapolate that and how to apply it to my sport. And I've even had pressure classes and had students in other sports. Like I've had some agility students with pressure issues. I've had some scent work students with pressure issues, because it's there. It's always there. It's like always there. And then kind of figure out, all right, well, like what techniques, what things can I do to help my dog, right? Because nobody was doing them and nobody had anything. So I was like, well, what do I do? Make my dog, you know? So, and then since I learned that and came up with these things, whatever, like now I'm obsessed with it, like probably to the point of like going way too far off the rails in the other direction. which you know, I've done that. I'm like so hypersensitive to it because I just started to recognize, and you know, but I don't think that's bad because
no,
I feel pressure the way dogs feel pressure now. Like I can be looking at my dog and healing and feel when my training partner who's trying to put some pressure on my dog, I can feel the pressure the same second that I see my dog's ear go like flick and acknowledge the pressure.
Yeah.
Right. So that, I think that's a good thing. Like I'd rather be hyper aware of it.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Cause then I can relate to the dog, right. And react in a timely manner.
Right.
And you know, so yeah. So basically if you suspect, so here's a perfect example. I had a student a long time ago. So she went to a trial, her dog didn't drop on the drop on recall. So she said, my dog didn't drop. It was a naughty dog. It's a drop error. It's a failure to respond to my cue. I'm like, is it really? And I knew where she was. And I said, let me see the video. So I looked at the video. And in my head, I'm like, 300% it's a pressure error. Because this building is, well, it used to be dark. It's in... They set you up in the far corner. So you're in a corner. You're in a really dark corner. And the wall is, there's a wall to the left of the dog, a wall behind the dog, and the judge is to the right of the dog. And then you leave the dog and you call the dog. So I said, okay, if it's a failure to drop, then when there's no pressure at all, the dog should not drop, right? So I said, go ahead, just in the middle of the room, do a drop on recall. She did it. Dog does it perfect. I said, all right, let's turn the lights off, put her in the corner, because it's a familiar training building, but put her in the corner, and I'm going to stand, I'm going to be where a little bit closer than where the judge was, because we're in your familiar training building, and it's me, right? Okay, call your dog. Calls your dog, tells the dog to drop. Dog doesn't drop, because the dog wanted to get the fuck out of there. Yeah, it's like, get me out of there. That is so uncomfortable. It's like, I just want to get to my mom as quickly as possible. No, I don't want to down, because down puts me in a vulnerable position. Now I'm not even standing. I'm down, right? And this judge is behind me and all this pressure is around me.
Yeah.
So why does it matter? So if I say to the dog in that moment, when the dog doesn't down in that moment, naughty dog, get down. I said, get down. I'm adding pressure onto pressure. Next time my dog is in the ring in a pressure situation, it's going to be a disaster. It's going to feel even worse, because not only is the dog uncomfortable because of the pressure, the dog's like, oh, and every time I'm under pressure, I get into trouble.
Yeah.
And you're going to end up in a real, it's just never going to get any better. It's only going to get worse and worse, right? So in that moment, I'm not going to say to the dog, naughty dog, you didn't down, right? I'm going to work on making the dog more comfortable with pressure. So I'm going to do a whole bunch of games, right? And we can do a whole nother episode just on pressure. I'm going to do a bunch of games to help the dog be comfortable with that pressure, more comfortable with the pressure. Right. So that's a completely different way of handling the error than if the dog was not under any pressure and came running in, and I gave it the down signal and it didn't lie down. Then I'm like, oh, well, now the dog doesn't understand the exercise.
Right.
So I would handle that completely differently.
Yeah. And I think it's important to bring up that I think pressure being one of the reasons we're talking about that errors occur can be a little harder for people to detect if they don't know what they're looking for, right?
Mm-hmm.
Opposed to a distraction of some sort or a handling mm-hmm. error. So I think I always kind of feel like it's the sleeper reason, like it's not real obvious unless people have explained it to you or you're able to read your dog and you can notice not only you know, where your dog is, like in their surroundings, like you said, like the dark building and the corner and the rain gates and the judge, but reading your dog before the error happens, you know, and the dog is already telling you through behavior changes, body posture, ear flicking, whatever, that they're feeling that pressure. I think a lot of people just, who are new to the sport or new to any sport need to learn how to recognize those signs in their dogs.
And usually when they're under pressure, dogs want to, they either freeze, so they do nothing. So it's the classic, like my dog was looking right at me and I gave it the signal and didn't do it. It couldn't. It was feeling too much pressure. It was uncomfortable. They flee, so they move out of position, right? So, like, in essence, that drop on recall, the dog not dropping was fleeing.
Yeah.
It was running away or forward motion on exercises, right? Or the dog, like, running past something or whatever. It's fleeing. It's trying to get out of there, right? Yeah. Or the dog, sometimes when they're, like, dogs doing zoomies or dogs, like, running and they're like, oh, he's just playing or he's being silly or whatever. Uh-uh. Fleeing. He wants to get away from the pressure. Yeah. Another one is fawning, like a big one that like people see where they're like, oh, my dog is so friendly. It just like it leaves me and it goes and it jumps on the judge or it jumps on the steward. Take a video of it. There's a difference between friendly and between fawning. Fawning is when the dog does not want you there and it's trying to control the space, so it's desperately jumping up and down at you and maybe even frantically licking you because they're trying to push you out of their space is really what they're doing. And I had a dog like that, like Zayden. He hated being touched, so if someone like approached him, he would run, leap up onto that person and push into them and act like he was licking them. He really was just trying to get them. He was saying,
Get
away from me. Yep. And there's like kind of a frantic, frenetic kind of look to it.
Yeah.
And people tell me all the time, always, I'm like, no. I'm like, every dog hates to stand for exam. I mean, how would you like it if I took you somewhere, stood you, said, stand there, walked away, and some stranger walked up and started touching you? It's disgusting. It's the most creepy, disgusting thing. And yet, what's wrong with my dog? Why is it moving? Why wouldn't it stay? Zesty hates the exercise. Yeah. Hates it. And you know what? He has a right to hate it. Because if I were a dog, no one would hate it more than me. And I would probably be like, I would probably want to put
you would be excused.
I'd get excused because I'm like, get away from me. And so we're saying like, don't move. Don't look at them.
Yeah.
You know, like do this, do that. And the dogs are like, oh God, help me. Right. So again, it's reading the dog's behavior. There's a difference between, oh, I'm running and having fun, or, oh, hi, I like you. And I'm trying to do this behavior so you move away and so I don't have to do this exam, or so that I don't have to stand here while mom or sit here or lie here while mom walks away, right?
Right.
So it's reading that behavior because it's very different and it's misread and misinterpreted
immensely,
constantly, like all the time.
For sure.
Yeah. So that's like, it's one of my obsessions that I like just constantly try to impress upon people. You know, like what a big impact that's having on the dog. And it's that way in every single sport. You know, we're asking the dogs to do something that's unnatural, that has rules, right? So, and in that, and because of that, you are going to be putting your dog into situations where they're going to feel pressure in some way, shape, or form.
Right.
And we have to identify when an error is being caused by pressure. And then we have to say, okay, what can I do to make my dog comfortable in this situation? Instead of saying, how am I going to get my dog to do the correct behavior? I have to make you comfortable first. Like, I'm not even worried about the correct behavior. Like, if I turn around and look at my dog and my dog is uncomfortable, I am not even going to ask my dog to do a behavior. I will never, ever. Like, if I turn and look at my dog and my dog looks worried, concerned, you know, is moving, anything at all, first thing I'm going to do is, okay, I have to get my dog comfortable here. Then I'll worry about asking for the behavior. Because if I ask the dog for a behavior, it's going to get it wrong.
Exactly.
So why even bother?
Right.
And then it's my fault. I consider that my error because I asked you to do something that you're not capable of doing. Because if you're not comfortable and I ask you to do the behavior and you don't do it, that's my bad.
Yeah. And that goes back to, it is so, so important to learn how to read your dog so that you're not asking them to do things when they just can't do it, you know? So if you don't recognize those signs in your dog and you just go ahead and ask and then they fail, then again, it's just going back to, you're going to get upset with your dog and you don't really understand why. So understanding pressure is a big one. And understanding the signs that your dog is feeling pressure is huge.
Yeah. And again, like, get help, right? Like, if you're new,
say, say it. Get help. 1-800. 1-800 pressure.
1-800 get help. Like, well, the good thing is, like, hey, guys, you have an advantage now. Like, there is actually information out there, a lot of information, or at least way more than there ever was in the past, on pressure and what it looks like and how it can affect your dog and your sport. There are instructors you can access online. Like, you're not limited to what's in your area, right? Like, so there's so much information that you can access. Like, you, if you're just like, yeah, I don't know, man, I'm really not sure, then I would ask somebody I trust. And if I didn't have anybody around me, I would contact somebody out there in the dog training planet and say, hey, can you help me with this? I'm not sure. Can you clarify this for me? And, you know, that's for sure how we learn.
Yeah, definitely,
right? Definitely. All right, so let's talk about distractions next, right? Distractions, which you mentioned, are in the form of, you know, well, dogs are dogs. How do they interact with the world? They smell, they sniff, they look, they use their eyes, motion really catches their eye, and auditory. They listen, they hear things that we cannot even hear. And so they're hyper aware of the environment, and that's genetic. It's how they survive. It's how they stay safe. So we have to teach them how to work, around distractions, like how to maintain concentration and focus with distractions going on around them. And I think this is in part kind of ties in a little bit with the generalization concept, because the thing with generalizing is every time, like if I take my dog, so when I have a young dog, I'll train it in my yard, right? Train in my yard, dog's like, yard's no problem. I take my dog to my front yard, and I do this all the time, and I may as well have gone to driven down the road, right? Why? Because it smells different, it sounds different, and it looks different. So now, A, my dog's like, whoa, what is all this new information coming into my brain? And B, it doesn't look or smell or sound like my backyard. So I can't assume that my dog is now going to be able to do the same quality of work in my front yard than it did in my backyard, never mind even come remotely close to being able to doing it at a competition.
Yeah. You know, I think there has to be a huge, huge appreciation to what we're asking these dogs to ignore. I mean, like you said, innately, that's how they interpret their whole world. That's how they figure out if they're safe. That's how they figure out if they're going to have a food source. Like, that's genetically in them for them to survive. So we're asking our dogs to do all these unnatural things because they are not born to do obedience. And we're asking them to do all that under innate things that they would normally be using to survive and be in the world. So I think my big thing on distractions is I feel that they need to be taught. You need to teach them incrementally and slowly and thoughtfully and mindfully. But you also need to deal with distractions. And I feel there's a huge majority of people who tend to avoid distraction training. So you'll get, yeah. I don't train outside. It's too hard. My dog sniffs the ground. Oh, my dog. If my dog sees a bird, it's over. Forget it. My dog's never going to, you know, like I hear this all the time. Or even in trials, like, oh, I won't trial there because whatever. That turf is always smelly. My dog, all the dogs sniff there. I don't like the light in there. There's birds that land on the gates. Like you, everything. Like there's that, right? And I do feel that, you know, you hear it, like I'll be either training with people or even at a trial with people. And if that's probably the number one complaint, oh, the floor's dirty. Fuck, my dog's going to be all over that floor. And yeah. I think that's a big thing. Like, and there is a way to train for distractions. Like you have to train for distractions.
Or God forbid a dog barks. Everyone's like, they look, my dog barks. They're looking at me like, your dog is barking.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's a dog show. Like, it has to bark. And like, I think it's obviously way more important in, like, you have to do a more thorough job in some sports than others. Definitely. Like, I think obedience and rally, you have to do an enormous amount of it. I feel like in rally, they really don't have a tendency to prepare their dogs enough. Like, they go to class, they do a course, and then they go to the trial. And probably when this episode comes out, I'll be either close to, right before, after, like, rally nationals. And these people take their dogs there, and the dogs are completely and utterly overwhelmed because it is a zoo. There are, like, a million rings. There's, like, 700, I think 600 yes. last year, 700 dogs packed into this building, dogs and handlers, and there's like a million rings going on at the same time, and the dogs are completely overwhelmed. Or people have gone to the Classic, which is a tournament in Florida, which is one of the hardest sites of every site in the whole country ever. And, you know, and then it's like live streamed, and that, which, and this part make, I think is terrible. Like, people will critique it and say, well, look at those dogs. They're not even trained. No, the poor dogs are like overwhelmed because they're like, oh my gosh, like There's overhead speakers. You can hear the dogs in dock diving. You can hear the agility. Like, it is just sheer insanity. There's like 8 or 10 rings going on at the same time. It's just chaos, right? The dogs aren't untrained. They're just not prepared for that environment. And people, you know, like, I go to the Walmart, put my dog in front of the doors. It is mass chaos. Like, I walk away and turn to give my dog a signal. My dogs can't even see me. There's people. I have to wait till somebody finishes passing. My dog's like trying to lean around the person. Humans do weird things. Like, people stop next to my dog and stare down at it. Like, what are you, why is this dog just standing here? Like, right. And so someone may say, like, why are you doing that to your dog? It's never going to encounter that in real life, in a trial or whatever. Well, I need my dog to generalize the concept, right? So if I'm going to take my dog and I'm going to go to the to nationals with it, and there are 6 rings going on at the same time, or I go to the classic and all that chaos is going on, well, I can't train for every single scenario that they're going to see there. I'm teaching my dog that no matter what happens, just concentrate on me.
Yeah.
And obviously I don't start there. I mean, it takes me years and years and years and years to be able to get a dog that they can do that kind of work under that amount of distraction.
Right.
Many, many, many years of going to the store multiple, multiple times, right? So I'm going to throw my training partner under the bus.
Oh, God.
Because we recently went to the Walmart. We were in a garden center, right? So I did Zesty. It was really crowded. It was a crazy. He was awesome. Like, I was really happy with him. Okay. So he goes and he gets his dog out. His dog's failing and failing and failing. And I'm standing there and I'm like, I'm trying to get him to figure these things out on his own. So I'm trying not to micromanage him. Right. So finally, I can't help myself. I have to intervene. So I go, I ask him, I said, how many days a week do you come to like someplace this busy? 1. I said, for how many months? Maybe 6 weeks. I said, how many times a week do you think I come to these places? Of course, he underestimated. My answer is like 3 to 4, right? For how many months? He's like 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm like, try again. 1 year, try again. 2 years, try again. 5 years. So what makes you think you can take your dog and your dog can do the same level of distraction as mine? It can't.
Right.
It was overwhelmed. He needed to move the dog. So we went outside. We went, you know, outside the garden center, in front of the store, but like off to the side. And even there, it was challenging. But it was challenging, but we could have some success.
Yeah.
Right? So the goal is not to like overwhelm the dog, because then the dog's going to say, every time I'm in this situation, I flunk and flunk and flunk, and dog's not even going to want to work, right? They're going to go down a rabbit hole. Like, it's all about success, which is why I do it for years and, you know, weeks and days and months and years, because it takes, I just keep upping the ante a tiny little bit at a time. Like, when they're young, if I have driven half an hour, 40 minutes to a location, taking a young dog out, warm the dog up. The dog can work maybe 5 minutes. I can see that that's like really hard for them. Yeah. And at the end of the 5 minutes, their head's about to explode. Guess what? Pack up the truck, drive all the way back home. Because I am not going to bury that dog and make it fail. Like, that was all the dog, that was all that the dog could do. The dog had success. I'm out of there.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So it's that fine line of like, you have to introduce it a little bit at a time so the dog can be successful, but you can't avoid it either. Because if you avoid it, your dog's just, you're doing your dog a disservice.
Well, yeah, because you know, you cannot stay in like sterile environments just to avoid that stuff. So your dog stays focused on you, because I think that's the big thing. Well, my dog won't pay attention to me. Well, you need to train for that. Mm-hmm. They don't just come automatically paying attention to us. So you have to train for that. And like you said, it needs to be done incrementally. So going back to the stores that we do, when we take the dogs to the stores, and you start off, because people are going to want to know, well, how do you do that? Well, you go to, let's say we pick Home Depot. I go to Home Depot in my town. The parking lot itself is freaking distracting, because mm-hmm. there's, if you go early in the morning, mm-hmm. all the construction guys are there. Yep. Yeah, they're all there loading trucks, right? So if I were to pick that time to go, which I tend to do in the summer because it's hot and it's cooler in the morning, I'm going to go as far away mm-hmm. as possible, right? So I'm going to go all the way to the other side of the parking lot where nobody's parked, no trucks are pulling in. But I'll tell you what, it's still distracting enough. It's still
hard. Yep.
It's still hard. And that you need to be honest and okay if you pull your dog out. And you can't, even if you can't, like you said, if you can't get, or you only can get a minute of attention, even some tricks, pack it up and go home. Because like you said, you don't want to bury your dog, right? Mm-hmm. Or you might even say, this is even too hard for my dog. My dog can't even look at me. So you just have to say, this is too hard. I need to find a different place that is not as near as distracting or busy as this. And that's okay. And you have to start where you need to start for your dog, to build them up, to be able to handle distractions and have an okay relationship with distractions, right?
Yeah. And the key goes back to what we talked about earlier, is count your mistakes, right? So that's where my training partner, where I was like, the reason I intervened was the dog was making too many mistakes. What does that mean? It means it's too, something's too hard for the dog, right? It's that whole two mistakes. Your dog makes two mistakes. Well, you got to change something, right? It means it's just too hard. And the other thing that's super important, if you're going to do distraction work, like I'll start it with a dog that's not fully trained, meaning all their behaviors are not fluent. But what I ask them to do in a new environment is fluent. So that could be as simple as just tricks. So if I have a young dog, I might go to the parking lot, all the way to the quiet end of the parking lot, and say, can you do some tricks? Can you run to your mat? Can you go on your perch and, you know, pivot around the perch? And because those things I know you know really, really well, right? Because I'm not going to ask you to heel if you don't even know how to heel in my backyard.
Right.
You're just going to fail, right? I'm not going to do a behavior that you don't know really well. So I'll just, but I can always do tricks and I can always do things with props, because I build super strong associations with props. At home with my little puppies, and I do that every single training session so that I always have that to use if I go somewhere.
Right. Yeah, and I think there's got to be a strategy when you're doing this, because you need to definitely not go to Home Depot and go right in front of the store for a dog who's never, ever had any distraction work before, or a really young dog, and be like, let's do commands. Let's try commands. Like, so don't set your dog up. Like, don't pick something that's hard in a hard, like start small. Like you said, can't. First of all, my big temperature taker for my dogs is, first of all, can you take food from me in this environment? Because if you're not even interested in food, there's no way in hell I'm going to ask my dog to do anything else.
Right.
And a dog who's toy driven crazy, if you're not going to play with your toy here, then you're worried. So I'm not going to ask my dog to do any complicated behaviors there. So I'm always taking my dog's temperature, and I'm going to start super small, and I can always build it up, and I can always get closer to the distraction. So always start small, start far away, and then just make yourself, just that, you know, the progression has to be, mindful so that you can always go back. Like, oh, this got really hard for my dog. Let me make it easier for them. Because we do, like you said, we want them to be successful. We want them to have a great relationship under that those environmental distractions.
Yeah. And they're not machines. Like I remember, I can't remember when it was, but so my train, we had been to the PetSmart before, like many times, right? And I forget, maybe we hadn't gone in a little while. Anyway, we went to the PetSmart, we met in the parking lot, and we planned to go in the PetSmart. We never made it out of the far end of the parking lot. For yeah. whatever reason that day, none of our dogs, they could barely even, like, we literally had to keep simplifying the behavior. I was like, what is wrong with the three of them? But I'm not going to say, what is wrong with you? You should know how to do this, you stupid dog, and force it or force the dog into the building. I basically just kept simplifying and simplifying until I could get success. And then we were like, okay, we drove all the way out here just to work in the corner of the parking lot. It is what it is. Like yeah. on that day, that was where, for some reason, all three dogs were at. And so that's what we did. And we never even made it to the front of the store, never mind in the store, right? And that's okay. Like it just yeah. is what it is on that day. I'm not going to force it just because my dog's done it in the past. And it requires so much maintenance. Like if I don't go to the stores for 4 months and then I go back, I guarantee you both of my dogs are going to struggle the first few times.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that kind of focus just requires a lot of work and maintenance. Yeah. Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, I don't know what it is. I think, you know, people get a little stuck in their plan. You know, I'm going to go to Home Depot and I'm going to go park there and I'm going to do this with my dog. And then it falls apart. And for some reason, people want to just push it to, you know, they want to force it to happen. And you cannot do that. Like that is a big, big, big one. No. You know, just that's just going to, you're just going to do more harm than good that way.
It's always the two opposites, right? It's like they either avoid it because it's too hard or they go and they overdo it. It's too, they make it too yeah. hard for the dog.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's always about finding the middle, right? But it's always about keep the errors down, keep the success rate high. Right. And if you're not meeting those two simple goals, then you need to change something. And the answer is almost always simplify. And simplify means either make the behavior easier or pick a behavior your dog knows better. Or decrease the challenge of the environment, whether it's pressure from a person or pressure from a wall or distractions that are going on around the dog, no matter what it is, you have to make it easier so your error rate is low, your success rate is high.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. All right. Do we want to talk about...
chaining is the last thing, right?
Yeah, chaining.
So chaining yeah. is just, I think the way to find out if it's a chaining error is it the interesting to me about thing to me about chaining is you don't, you can do it all by yourself or worst case, you just need one other person, right? Cause yeah. If it's a chaining error, my dog will do the exact same thing in the training building I always train in with my training partner, Carl. So all we do is, you know, I warm the dog up. I take food off me. I enter the ring exactly the same way as I would in a trial. And this is where people go awry. They don't act the same way. They start talking to their training partner or they start helping the dog or doing different things. No, just go in exactly like you would in a trial and start the class. Right. And if at some point the dog starts giving you the same behaviors, it disconnects, it struggles, it looks worried, it, you know, it can't do the work, then it's a chaining error. The dog's making the mistake because it's not getting any information, right or wrong. So we're not saying you're right. We're not saying you're wrong. We just keep continuing on. And the dog starts to get worried. Oh, God. Like, they haven't told me anything. Like, I don't know. Am I right? Am I wrong? Like, what is happening? Like, if when I was teaching Zaina how to chain, if I would tell her, ah, don't do that, she was like so happy. I'd be like, what is wrong with her? And then I'm like, oh yeah, right. She just wants information.
She wants, it's that lack of feedback. It's that lack of feedback that causes the dogs to worry. And then, so any feedback could essentially make your dog feel like relief, you know?
Yeah, like, thank God she told me something, right? So you have to then carefully, again, slowly, step by step, teach your dog that just because you're like, I want my dogs to understand that no information means you're correct. Just keep going. You're going to get a jackpot. I don't know when you're going to get it. It's going to be a surprise, but you're going to get it eventually. So keep going. You're correct. Instead of the dog going, I'm going, but I'm not sure. I think I'm wrong. I don't know. I don't know. And then they end up messing up. Because they're just too worried.
They're too worried. And I think it's this enormous gap that is with people who train and they maybe they're not aware of all the help they're giving in their training all the time. And then the dogs are doing well in training. So they enter a trial and they go to the trial and maybe not the first time, but maybe the second, but I guarantee you, at some point, the dog is going to notice that's not getting any feedback. And that's when the worry starts. And that's when you see dogs start to, it just will start to fall apart because then they start the lack of all that feedback that needs to be put into your training so that they learn, like you said, to keep going, that you are right, even though I'm not giving you any feedback, and that it will end eventually, this chain of behaviors we're doing, and that you will get a reinforcer, right?
Yeah, and I think it goes to, first of all, people have to be aware of how much they're reinforcing, right? So, like, I always say to my students, like, if a dog comes into heel position and you're giving it 2 or 3 cookies, what in the world are you doing? Like, that's 3 cookies for 1 really simple, well-known behavior. How are you going to get your dog to do 9 minutes of work?
Yeah.
Like, you're setting yourself up to fail. If every time you're like, oh, God, if your answer to every problem is grab more reinforcement, that's not going to be good either, because you're training your dog that the reinforcement is a cue system. Like, the dog says, okay, every 10 seconds I get a cookie, or every 30 seconds I get a cookie. And then when you change that pattern, the dog's completely confused. It's like, dude, you changed the pattern. I don't know what to do now. And then just getting the food off people's bodies is a challenge. Like, because people are inherently lazy. Like, yes, it is very inconvenient to every time I say yes to my dog to run over or walk over to where the food is. Well, just think of it as you're getting a couple of like 100 extra steps in your day. Yay for you. Right? Because that's why people don't take food off their body. It's inconvenient.
Yeah.
Like, it's inconvenient that my food is over there on the table or, wherever it is. And every time I want to reinforce my dog, I have to go to that table.
Right.
But it does 2 things. One is it gets the dog used to working with food not on your body, so your dog doesn't think it's weird. It's normal. And B, it makes you way more aware of how many cookies you're giving them. Because I see people all the time, like, they're just standing there and they give their dog a cookie. I go, what was that cookie for?
Yeah, same.
And they're like, Oh, I gave him a cookie. Yeah, you just gave him a cookie. Why? I don't know.
Yeah.
Right? You're not going to be doing it. You're not going to walk all the way over there to give your dog an I don't know cookie. It's too far away. Like, yeah. You're not going to do it.
Right.
Right. So you're going to start becoming aware. And like, sure, there are training sessions where I give my dog a ton of food. There are training sessions where I have food on me. But there are a lot of training sessions, starting when they're young, where the food is not on my body and it's over there somewhere, or the toy. Like a lot of my toys, usually I don't even know where it is. I tug with my dog, I drop it wherever right. it is. Yeah. Yeah. Right? When I release my dog, I send them to the toy. Right? But you have to be mindful and start doing longer and longer chains. And then just slowly teach your dog, like, see, it's okay. We went a little bit longer. Now you're getting a big reinforcer, right? Oh, look, we went even longer. Now you're getting a big reinforcer, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can't do that all the time either. So then people start chaining, and like every day they're doing long chains. And I'm like, oh my God, like,
yeah, right.
It's too much. It has to be balanced, right?
It has to be balanced, yeah.
Some days you're getting more. Some days you're getting less.
Yeah. I find that the struggle or the lack of chaining that can occur with people is the dependency on the food. Like, I get what you're saying, where they're lazy and they don't want to go over to the food. They just want to keep it on them. But I also feel... probably because I do teach a lot, and a lot of first time people into the sport, is the dependency on the food that I think people fall into that trap of, well, if I don't have the food, he's not going to do it. Right. Like, there's a huge, lack of skills, I think, with some people who are new and just learning on how to transfer from using the food to not using the food, right? And then they get caught with, well, I don't know how to teach my dog to do this without the food. And I, like, literally, I've got students who, they'll come into the ring with their hand in their fucking pocket.
I know.
Do you know your hand's in your pocket? Oh, no. Like, they're so afraid. They have to almost be touching the food. And I'm like, dude, that's when I'm like, take the food out, go put it on the table. And, like, they panic. I think there's this, I think there's a thing, like, where we teach the dogs all the things they need to do. And then if you're not versed in feeding the food while you're teaching the dog, then what happens is they get to the next step where they don't know how to do that. So then chaining doesn't even happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think people need to think from day one, right? Like, this is what I tell my students, like, that are starting out. I'm like, your dog is going to have to work for 9 to 11 continuous minutes with zero reinforcement, right? Like, if you're in a higher level obedience, that's a lot. That's a lot more than, like, other sports, right? So if your sport doesn't require that much, be happy. You just have to do that much less work to get them off it, right? But by thinking about that from day one, like, I'm always thinking to myself, like, does this dog really need a cookie here? Right? Because if it doesn't, I'm not giving it. Right? Good. Because now that's one less cookie that I have to fade later. Right? So, and I start, like, even in my foundation, in my engagement foundation classes, right away, it's like, teach your dog to work with the food off your body.
Yeah.
You know, because if you just do that right out of the gate, then it's a lot easier for you to do that later. And I think if they just keep that in the back of their mind, always, always, like, why am I giving this cookie? You know,
right.
Do I need to give it?
Or saying, like, eventually we need to be able to do this specific thing without a cookie, right? So to me, I'm always saying, okay, once my dog like, let's just put it in, let's just say I'm in my kitchen teaching my dog a behavior, and after X amount of weeks or months or however long for the dog to really become fluent in it, then without food, then I have to immediately say, I need to get the food off of me and start having the dog be able to do this X behavior without the food on me. So that has to be, because I think people get stuck with, well, how do I train the next step without food? Like, they don't understand that part, right? Mm-hmm. Which then that's how I'm like, why I say, like, then what happens is chaining goes out the window because they've never really learned how to do this behavior, which I've been using food for like ever, because they don't have that in their head. Like we just said, I'm trying to get rid of the food as quickly as possible. Like, because the end result is my dog has to work for X amount of minutes without a reinforcer. So I have to start with even a simple behavior. Once my dog knows this, now can I do it without a cookie? Now, can my dog do it twice without a cookie? With the cookies over on the counter? With the cookies over in the next room? Like, that's where it needs to be sort of threaded into, woven into your training a little bit.
And it's like that in every sport, really. Because, like, I'm sitting here thinking about, like, scent work, right? Like, at the highest level, those dogs are searching for a really long time.
Yeah.
Right. Like, huge spaces for a very long time. So you can't just go from short searches, feed, yes, feed, short, oh my God, that's a tongue twister.
Good one.
Short search, yes, feed, right? And then all of a sudden go, well, now I need you to search this enormous area. Like, your dog's going to search for a while, and even your most motivated dog, and then after a while, your dog's going to give up.
Yeah, right.
Because it's going to say, well, I don't know, like, I haven't gotten reinforced, like, they're going to be overwhelmed,
right?
So it's like with anything, you have to teach them, you know, a little bit at a time to work longer and longer and longer before they reinforce. Now, that doesn't mean that if your dog is at the highest level of scent work competition that you never have sessions where you do short searches. Of course you do.
Right.
Because your dog would get burnt out. Like, you have to mix it up. But you should always be thinking, like, as I'm headed, like, oh, okay, my dog can do this size search, no problem. Let me start doing a little bigger area once a week or twice a week. And then eventually a little bit of a bigger area, right? So your dog isn't going suddenly one day from doing short searches, and each time they find the source, they get reinforced, right? So they're getting reinforced X amount of time. And then all of a sudden, now there's this huge area. They're going to be like, I haven't gotten reinforced. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Like, I'm confused. They're going to start looking at the handler for information. Like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
So it's really like that in every sport. Yeah, some are probably more challenging than others, but still, you know, the dog has to learn to work and do X amount of behaviors to a certain standard for X amount of time before they get reinforced. And that has to be just built up over time. And you have to, I start thinking about that in any sport I'm in from day one. When I start training my puppy, I already know in the back of my head, like, this is where I'm headed. So, you know, step by step, week by week, month by month, year by year, you know, I have sessions where I'm always like, okay, push a little longer, push a little longer, push a little longer.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a big, I'm always reminding my students that and myself, you know, like, you don't want to stay stuck. I think people get stuck, you know, and there's not a progression going on. I'm always like, if you get to a point where your dog's got it, move on, make it harder, push it, you know? And like you said, like, you're always going to go back and do reinforcing sessions, things that are easier, shorter sessions, with a higher reinforcement rate. But at the end of the day, you have to start to weave in those longer and harder bit by bit for all the things that we're talking about, distraction training and pressure work and chaining, all that stuff. Because you have to, like you said, it was put perfectly, is you have to think of the end picture, like where you're going. What is the end goal? Your dog needs to work for whatever sport you're doing. Your dog needs to work for X amount of time in this environment without any feedback or reinforcer, so to speak, depending on what you're doing with your sport, right? And that's got to be trained incrementally.
Yeah. Yep. We have to. It's a lot of work. It's a but lot. It's fun. I think it's fun. I like it. I think it's fun.
I like it too.
Clearly, what it looks best. All right.
Yeah. Well, so
that's a lot of information. Well,
yeah. I think that, you know, and there's going to be a lot of episodes we do where we go back and talk about, obviously, Petra's definitely going to need a pressure episode.
Yes. We must do a pressure episode.
So we will be going back and touching on all these things of chaining, distractions, generalization. That needs to, you know, I'd love to be talking about that again. You know, so these things are, you know, and any questions you guys have, you guys can post on our Facebook page or message us, and we're happy to answer them. But we've got, you know, there's so many episodes we have ideas or so many ideas we have for episodes. So a lot of the stuff is going to be regurgitated over and over again.
Yeah. I think the main point today was the why, right? Yeah. Like that when a dog makes an error, why did it occur? All errors are not the same. All errors are not handled the same. It's our job to always figure out why. And that's what I'll say to my training partner all the time. Dog makes a mistake. I'll say, why? What was the root cause of that error? Like he'll go that he didn't down. Well, I know he didn't down. Why? The question should always be why, and you should be a detective, right? Don't be emotional. Put yourself in detective mode and say, okay, let me figure out why my dog made this error, go through the list that we talked about. And once you identify why, then you can fix it in a way that the dog's going to understand and the dog's going to have a positive experience and the dog's going to be able to not make that error anymore because you've been able to give the dog really good information.
Yep. Spot on. Definitely.
All right, everybody. So this was a long episode, but that's okay. We'll give you a short one next time.
Unless it's pressure.
No. We'll do like a random reflections next or something.
To balance it out
so your heads don't explode.
And we'll be posting some videos on the YouTube channel with a couple handling errors and pressure and how we deal with that, handling with distractions and how we deal with that. So you guys can see some examples of those.
Yep.
Okay.
All right. Good job.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye.